Exodus 14, 5 through 12. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his officials changed their minds about them and said, "What have we done? We have let the Israelites go and have lost their services." So he had his chariot made ready and took his army with him. He took 600 of the best chariots along with all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. The Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, so that he pursued the Israelites who were marching out boldly. The Egyptians, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots, horsemen and troops, pursued the Israelites and overtook them as they camped by the sea near Pi Hahiroth, opposite Baal Zephon. As Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, and there were the Egyptians marching after them. They were terrified and cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, 'Leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians'? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert."
They'd experienced 10 wondrous displays of God's power, 10 times when the world seemed to be flying apart for the Egyptians, for their enemies, but they were safe and sound. And then that final Passover night, the firstborn in every Egyptian household and barnyard died. But on the Israelite side of town, not even a dog was heard to bark. After spending their whole lives as slaves, they'd marched out of Egypt like conquerors. If they saw something they wanted, all they had to do was ask, and their former masters pressed it into their hands, saying, "Take it, just go." And now they say, "It would have been better to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." You talk about a short attention span. God knew their faith was weak. That's why he'd sent them on the road less traveled, away from the easy road that ran up the coast to Canaan. Instead, they were sent into the desert, carrying the bones of their forefather Joseph, until they find themselves here camped by the Red Sea. And that's where they were when Pharaoh's army rolled up, 600 motorized personnel carriers, the Sherman tanks of the ancient world, and now they are here, and you've heard that expression, between the devil and the deep blue sea. That's their situation. Having faith is hard work. I don't know if you've discovered that. You know, trusting God is with you and is going to care for you is easy when things are going great, when life is awesome. But when the outlook or the outcome of life is grim, oh, it's a different story. Faith is difficult to have at those times. That's when faith either fails or it's forged into something real, something active, something potent in our lives. Moses' advice to the people in this situation is, don't be afraid. Stand firm. The Lord will fight for you. You have only to keep still. And that last bit in the Hebrew is really blunt. It's more like, you have only to be quiet or shut up. This is it. If we can control our fear and stand in the right place, do the right thing, God is going to accomplish what needs to be accomplished. You know, it's not on us to do what only God can do. That's a refreshing reminder for some of us. And then verse 15 here in chapter 14. There's this puzzling response from God. The Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry out to me? Tell the Israelites to go forward." Now, Moses hasn't been the one whining, has he? Isn't this strange? And here again, just as at the first of his life, when he was set by his mother in that little basket on the river, his own little ark, we see that in some mysterious way, Moses is so fused with the Hebrew people that whatever happens to him is said to happen to the people, and whatever happens to the people is said to happen to him. And of course, at the same time, Moses stands between the people and God, and whatever Moses said or says becomes to them like the word of God. This nature of Moses here, his relationship with human beings, the people, and with God is amazing. It's both profound and it's enigmatic. It's mysterious. What is this nature of Moses here? How does he have this relationship? God instructs Moses, then Moses instructs the people. They are to go forward as Moses stretches out his hand over the sea. You notice that they're told to go forward in response to God's command before the waters start to divide. Faith is not seeing or experiencing the outcome before you move in response to God. It's moving forward, believing God will make a way. And God says, "I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians." So they're going to follow the people into the sea. And remember how God had been said over and over again to harden the heart of Pharaoh. And then there's this pillar, a pillar of cloud that led them by day and the pillar of fire by night. And this was probably something that we could maybe understand as even one pillar, depending on whether it's day or night that's there going before them. And now the pillar moves between the people and their enemy to protect them. And it says, the text says, that the pillar brings light to the people on God's side and darkness to the people on the other side. I kind of see all of these things. I think there's a common theme here. Think about a little experiment. On a warm, sunny day like today, if we took a block of ice and set it out on the sidewalk there, what would happen to it? It would melt over time here, right? Just like I feel like I'm doing when I'm out on the sidewalk about this time of year. Now imagine taking a big lump of wet clay out there and plopping it down beside the ice cube on the sidewalk. Same warm sun shining down on the ice cube that shines onto the big block of clay. What's going to happen to the clay? It's going to harden, isn't it? It's going to become dense and harden. So the two different responses is not dependent on the way they are acted upon. It's actually that the sun acts consistently on both of them, and they have very different responses. This makes me think of the way Jesus answered when he was asked, "Why are you speaking in parables?" And in one gospel, he says, "So that those who have ears to hear will hear." And you can go over into another gospel, and they ask him the same question, and he says, "So that those who don't have ears to hear will not be able to hear." They're two sides of the same coin here. For some people, the presence of God and God's instruction is illuminating, like a bright light that shines into the darkness. Illuminates the world, they see the world, and they see their way in the world and the way of God in the world. For other people, God's presence may obscure and may confuse them. And thank goodness, because evil needs to be confused in our world, it needs to be thrown into disorganization, or it would be even more destructive. So both of these responses is God's faithfulness to us. Then verse 21 in this chapter, Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and all that night the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind and turned it into dry land. And notice here, it takes all night. It doesn't happen instantaneously. Seems like it would have been more impressive if God had just snapped fingers and it happened, but it doesn't happen that way. And isn't this so much more how we experience God's presence and God at work in our world? We feel it or sense it faintly at first, just like a wind that blows or when the wind changes direction. And we, at first, we turn round and round. Which way is the wind blowing here? Which way is it coming from and where is it going? And then perhaps it becomes more, you know, stronger, and we start to sense a real direction. And before you know it, you're standing there holding on because the wind is blowing so hard it feels like you can't stand in it. And that's, I think, often how it is with the way God moves in our world, or we perceive at least God's movement. It's not like the snap of a fingers. It's like this imperceptible, almost, wind that begins to blow stronger and stronger. Maybe God takes time like this because we need to get in on it, and we're not real quick on the uptake sometimes. Sometimes it takes us a long time to come around to follow God the way we need to. And again, in this verse about Moses stretching out his hand and the sea being driven back, I want you to notice, and I probably start to sound like a broken record on this whole time we've been in Exodus, but you've got to notice this creation theme that underlies all of this story. What does God do as the wind blows? He divides the sea and dry land appears. Have you heard that somewhere before? That's Genesis 1. He divides the sea and dry land appears. God makes a way through the waters. Remember, the sea represents chaos and evil and disorganization in these stories. And the waters are dangerous and scary. People don't approach the waters like a day at the beach. This is not fun in the sun. This is dangerous. And just like we would respond to flood or to being out in deep waters, there's this fear. But God creates and recreates, and God's work brings life in the middle of waters, in the middle of dangerous times. People of faith are asked to move forward before the way through the waters appears. And then they have to keep moving. Here's a wall of water on one side, water on the other side, and behind you is this enemy, the forces of destruction coming up behind. An army who was bent on their destruction. Really, if you put it all together, it's a terrifying picture. No wonder they were so afraid. No wonder this is the way they're responding. It's absolutely terrifying. It's night. They're walking through a sea on dry land. How much is invisible to them? And but they keep moving forward through it. God is at work in the world, and we also have to keep moving, even through fear, in the direction God sends us. It will not be easy, and sometimes it will be terrifying. And, you know, I think about this whole picture, and I think when you get hung up trying to figure out the relationship between God's grace our response in faith, the place of the works that we do in this world, our own actions. When you think about the idea of salvation, contemplate this picture. Contemplate this picture of these people in this moment and how God is working for them on their behalf and what God sends them to do. The Egyptians pursue into the sea. The Lord looks down and throws their enemy into confusion. And now their chariots, the symbol of their power and their might, which struck such fear into God's people, they begin to break down. They're ineffective. And then verse 26, the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea so that the waters may flow back over the Egyptians and their chariots and horsemen." And Moses stretched his hand out over the sea. Can you hear? "Peace, be still." And at daybreak, the sea went back to its place. The Egyptians were fleeing toward it. They're so confused. And the Lord swept them into the sea. The water flowed back and covered the chariots and horsemen. The entire army of Pharaoh that had followed the Israelites into the sea. And not one of them survived. And as morning dawns, the people of God see their enemy lying dead there along the seashore. What a picture. Well, the first Christians looked at these stories just as their foremothers, the Israelites, had done. And they saw in them truths that would emerge in how God related to them. And the first Christians, the church, saw these stories as shadows for which Christ was the reality. And we noticed last week when we were talking about that original Passover in Egypt, how it was seen by the church as a symbolic of Christ's victory over evil through the cross, and how the Passover meal became a model for our communion supper. Well, the Red Sea crossing as well is influential. They also see this connecting with what was happening in Christ. And they see this applying to the church's past, to the church's present, and to the church's future. It's a powerful symbol for the early church. For instance, when Jesus' father and mother bring him out of hiding in Egypt and settle in Nazareth, the Gospel of Matthew recalls this passage in Hosea where God says, "When Israel was a child, I loved him. And out of Egypt, I called my son." And so when Matthew says, "Out of Egypt, I called my son," we think back to that passage in Hosea. And he's alluding to the fact that just as Moses has a special relationship with the people and with God, so Jesus is understood in some sense to have this special relationship. And Jesus is understood to be living out somehow Israel's whole experience. And Jesus will live as Israel should have lived. He will be the ultimate Israel. Then in the Gospel of Luke, you could look at the story of the Mountain of Transfiguration. And his disciples see Jesus transformed there. And then see Jesus talking with Elijah and with who? Moses. And then Luke says this, "They spoke about his departure, which he was about to bring to fulfillment at Jerusalem." Now what's lost in translation here into English is that this word departure in Greek, which is what Luke was writing in, is the word exodus. They're not just talking about the fact that Jesus will be killed and what will happen there in Jerusalem. They're saying that this whole thing that's happening You can best think of it if you think of Exodus, that whole package of meaning that goes around it. The book of Hebrews also compares Christ to Moses and basically says that Christ will do what Moses could not do, deliver his people out of a world corrupted by sin and death, governed by a ruler that's far worse than any Pharaoh, and lead them into a recreated world, far better than the original promised land. Christ is stronger than, greater than Moses. In 1 Corinthians, the Apostle Paul compares the Red Sea crossing directly to Christian baptism. Chapter 10, our ancestors were all under the cloud, and they all passed through the sea. He says, they were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. So you see, their imagination is captured by the story. It fills their minds. This is how they think about their faith in the world. Those who are baptized into Christ, for Paul, it's like Israel passing through the Red Sea. They enter a new way of life. And the implication for him in this is if you enter into this new way of life, you need to leave behind the old way of life that you once knew. And then finally, the book of Revelation, which mixes the Exodus motifs with themes from the Babylonian exile to produce this very vivid, very imaginative picture of our past, our present, and our future as the church. God's enemies in Revelation are slowly and methodically destroyed by a series of disasters that look just like plagues. And this is presented as God's ultimate judgment on any world power that opposes God's will for creation. And then in the end, in Revelation, Babylon, symbolizing Rome, symbolizing every other world order that opposes God, Babylon is thrown like a millstone into where? Into the sea. Like Pharaoh, Babylon perishes in the sea, sinks to the bottom, given over to the chaos and the destruction that characterized its rule. And then at the end of the story in Babylon, I'm sorry, in Revelation, in that last chapter 21, the prophet sees a new heaven and a new earth. But what does he say specifically is not there? Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, and there was no longer any sea. So you see how these stories all meld together into one story. He sees no more destruction, no more death, no more chaos or evil, nothing to fear. That's why he can say there will be no sorrow and no tears. God will wipe away every tear. Now, when people read this book, Revelation, most people want to know, is this what's happening in the future? Or is this somehow what happened in the past through Christ, Christ's victory and the cross, through the garden, the tomb, and new life that God gave to Christ? Or is this some way happening right now? And the answer to that, as the Israelites saw their own story, as the prophets explained it, as the saints of God said it, the answer is yes, is all of those things. It's happening now. It happened in the past. It will be our future as well. Now, I want to be careful to say that thinking of Exodus, this whole package of meaning here, as a pattern for the way God deals with us is not to say that that is going to be the way that we experience every hardship that we face. You know, those first Christians, as you think about Paul's letters, or Peter, when they spoke of the very real suffering that they were facing for following Christ, not to mention just the average aches and pains and sorrows that it takes to live, they didn't talk Exodus. They talked endurance. They said that's the answer to these things. See, not every person that we consider our enemy is Pharaoh. We're not told to throw our enemies into the sea with millstones. We're told to love our enemies. We're told to pray for those people who persecute us. But this is a pattern, because God is the same today and yesterday and tomorrow. And when we wonder about certain things, I think, in life, those deeper things in life, I think we can go back to this Exodus story. When we think about how is it that Jesus both represents God and us, humanity, perhaps we can think about Moses' place in this story. When we're confused about how God's grace and our faith, our works, interact with each other to produce whatever we mean when we call salvation. And don't you know, God's got a whole lot bigger picture of salvation than we do. But whenever we think about that, think about this story. And when in this life we're troubled because, you know, we say Christ won the victory over evil and death in the cross, but there sure is a lot of evil and sin and death still operating out in our world. How can this be? I think we should ponder this story. Where are we in this story? We've been told to go forward. Is it ours to say? And then maybe, as we think about this, we can perhaps begin to understand that this eternal one, who was the same yesterday, today, and forever, who gave us this picture of love and faithfulness, maybe as we ponder that, then it will be easier for us to believe that God is even now working out with great purpose, with sureness, to bring about some way of deliverance for the church, for his people, for this earth, humanity, this deliverance from evil and from danger, to bring life, a way of life in the middle of the sea, in the middle of danger, in the middle of destruction. Oh, if we could have that confidence, if we only had a picture like that, that told us what this story was like, maybe we could go forward with confidence. If you're here today, there's any way that we can minister to you, I invite you to come as we stand and sing.